The March to Redeem the Soul of America paused on April 4th, 2006, to observe the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King in Waxahachie, Texas, at the Straightway Church. The first speaker you'll hear here at a roundtable discussion is Valley Reed, main organizer of the March to Redeem the Soul of America.
To take action, to go out at the grassroots level and make things happen. And I see it happening with a very small group of people in this march, and it's very inspiring to me, the commitment and the spirit and the stamina. And I think this is real activism that's really happening here, you know, since we started this march. I've been doing working with the Peace Center in Dallas for 3 or 4 years and doing many different kinds of events and different kinds of actions. And this is, I have to say, this is different than anything that I've been involved with. And it's been very challenging in terms of the enormous goal of trying to walk this far and the different aspects of trying to create that. But I really think what it comes down to is just a small group of people being willing to do something. That is the most powerful thing. And really, it works. You know, to see that it works, it's very inspiring. It makes me very happy. So that's kind of it.
So you're responsible for coming to these towns raising all this hell, huh?
Well, I'm part of it. I'm not going to take all the responsibility.
She brought fear to talk to the police.
Anyway, he does such a good job.
Where are you from?
I grew up in Abilene in West Texas.
Okay.
We're going this way?
No. That's easy to walk. Come on. That's a walkway.
Well, my name is Hadi Jawad. My father was born in Iraq. He left Iraq when he was 8 years old. And my grandfather and grandmother moved to Bombay, India. When India was divided, they moved to Pakistan, and that's where I was born. First of all, please forgive me for not being here today and yesterday. I marched with y'all Saturday and Sunday, and it was exhilarating to be part of this this effort. And all day yesterday, I just want you to know that I was not here in body, but my mind was with you guys all day yesterday and today. And I wanted really bad to be here marching with you. It's indeed a very special effort, and I'm really grateful for the new connections and friendships, Nick and Charles and Sunny and Trap Rock Center, that we have been hearing about and knowing about for a very long time, the great work that this institution does for peace and justice up in Massachusetts. We've had several of your folks come through here before. I'm thinking of Doug Rocky, who came here not too long ago, spoke to us in Dallas and Crawford. I've been watching Valley go through this, organizing this thing, and she has been sort of in the shadows of, you know, our organizing efforts all these years. And when this opportunity came up, I encouraged her and wanted her to take on this challenge. But I also knew that I still had my grubby little fingers in there all the time as she was doing this, and she was not doing this right and not doing that right. And I know what a tremendous opportunity this has been for her. So thank you all, Lon and Nick, and for trusting her and giving me the opportunity to really trust her that she can do it.
Just an opportunity for us all.
I know, it's really good. I mean, and She's really, really a good organizer. She covers details like, I mean, we do stuff right off the hip is how we operate. Just to give you a little quick story about this, it has to do with the Crawford Peace House. Y'all can take this with you. One of the big questions that reporters used to ask us last August when Cindy was there, that they saw this whole operation of the Crawford Peace House and how we dealt with thousands of people. And towards the end, we sort of had it down. I mean, we were doing really good, you know, handling people and the myriad of issues that used to confront us on a daily basis, right? Who all was there last August? Can I have a show of hands? Okay, all right. So you all know the chaos and how everything sort of came together in a miraculous sort of way. So the reporters used to ask us, you know, this is such a well-organized event. You all must have really planned this. So I was talking to Rolling Stone magazine, one of their senior reporters, wanted to get an in-depth story about who we were. And he wanted to go right in the beginning of how we got started. And I said, right after September 11, we got this opportunity to come down. Somebody suggested to us that it might be a good opportunity to create a peace house in Crawford. So this is before the peace house. It was just an idea. Nothing had happened yet. So Johnny and I got in his truck one day, and Johnny had obtained some really detailed surface maps. What are they called? Land maps?
Topography.
I mean, detail where the creeks were, where the roads were, of that whole region. And Johnny and I came down in his truck, and we were gonna check out that whole area and see what it was like. We were thinking about bringing some... Tony Blair was supposed to come to the Crawford Ranch to finalize plans for Packer Rock, and we were going to do a demonstration. We wanted to see what sort of highways, freeways, how it all, county roads, and how it all, which angles can we come in from, what are we going to do. So we left after work. We came down, and dusk was beginning to fall, and it's getting dark, and we didn't know the area at all. So we were driving around, and at one point we confessed to ourselves that we were lost. We didn't know where we were. We totally turned around. So Johnny said, he pulled off the side of the road, and he asked me to turn the dome light on, and I couldn't turn it on. It had burned out. So he said, look in the glove compartment. There might be a flashlight in there. So I said, okay. So I opened the glove compartment, found the flashlight, and... And we got the topographical map out, and we were sitting there. We are on the roads that surround the president's ranch. Okay, I want y'all to know, we are that close to the ranch. There's a road that goes around the ranch, and it's dark now. There's no light in our truck, and we are both sitting there looking at this detailed map. And it occurs to us at the same time, both of us looked at each other and said, "Now, if there's a cop pulls up over here and finds Johnny and me on Iraqi descent." This is like a 2 months after 9/11.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting in detailed
on my way to hell.
So I told the Rolling Stone guy. Rolling Stone guy, this is how organized we are. This is how brilliant we are. This is how much thought we have given to what we're trying to do here. So. Isn't that an incredible story? I think back and I'm just blown away.
It's hard to get lost in that area, though. It's very dark. And
yeah, there's no landmarks.
There's no signs.
It's very... Thank you. I love you all. This is a great... I was drawn to that photograph also of the Last Supper, Christ talking to disciples. Kind of reminds me of what's happening in that photo.
Mm-hmm. Two of which were women, right? Are two women in that picture?
I know one.
Personally?
I'm not going to tell the military secrets.
Anyway, I'm so enthralled with what you all were saying, I wasn't really thinking about what I'm going to say, so I don't know what the hell. It's been great being here. I've made some new friends, and I'm really loving it. If you haven't seen me today, I've been with you in a different realm on the internet and getting all the pictures of the first couple of days around the internet. every single event that we had is one of them.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
The press conferences are on there in their entirety, all three press conferences.
Great.
In audio.
I also have video.
Wow.
Little QuickTime movies, and those will be going up at some point. But as Nick knows well, we didn't have a broadband connection at the motel. It was 1/4 of dial-up speed. So it was crawling, and he's been letting me his computer so I can kind of upload things in bulk, you know. But invariably, I messed up somehow, and I trying to make those little edits is what I call the time, really. But anyway, I'm from Massachusetts, and of course, everyone's heard about Crawford Peace House, and being with an independent peace center myself, Trap Rock. I've certainly heard of Dallas Peace Center. We've done some work with Dallas Peace Center. But at any rate, it's really been great, and I've been working with Nick on the boycott, the war boycott, and trying to help with little things. And one thing I've been doing is documenting as best I can the the things here, and also getting things up on the internet. And right now they're at the TrapRockPeace.org website. And we've invited Consumers for Peace and March to Redeem to take photographs if they want. Just take them off the website and use them. And so these are available for the online sites, Dallas Peace Center too, of course. So one thing I'm doing now is I'm taping. But if you don't want me to tape you, just let me know and I'll turn the tape off. Okay. I wasn't anticipating taping a roundtable thing. We were talking about having a public presentation before. Those are a little bit of a different story. But here, people telling their own stories, and if you don't want me to tape it, just give me the high sign, and I'll just turn it off. But at any rate, I really appreciate you all being here. It's been great.
Well, I just want to say Charlie is extremely meticulous, and this kind of documentation will be very valuable to people everywhere. And it's something where you're really doing what the press and documentation should be doing, and it's a very unique thing that's been going on here, and it's really hard kind of
historian. It's a historian.
Yeah, it's really very, very fine that you've been wanting to do this. So, I think everybody will appreciate it, and certainly it'll be something a lot of people refer to.
Well, thank you. It's been a collaboration. I mean, support from Consumers for Peace has really made it possible.
Thank you, Charlie.
And the local host, of course.
Thanks.
My name is Tom Friedley. I can't follow all this great sharing that's been going on ahead of me. I'll keep it brief, as a lot of us here tonight. I'm kind of happy, actually. Jim and I had come up on the bus ahead of the march this morning with the intent of kind of updating the flyer and seeing if we had a meeting, an event tonight, we could have something to give out that was covering the rest of the march, the whole schedule. Nice little graphic from the website feature on top. We found out this was not Dallas. You can't just go anywhere and find internet access and a laser printer in Waxahachie. So if nothing else, I learned that today. It occurs to me as I listen to everybody, I think we all have something that we're really good at. I'm not a particularly religious person, but I prefer the term spiritual. I think we have a gift that we can offer up. There's something that gets you excited about getting out of bed every day. And I think if we're doing that, and we're all doing that consistently, or trying to at least, and sort of working out of our strengths, covering where everybody else might be weak, organizers, you got media people who speak well, others who love, computer geeks like me, or some like maybe Charles, that we can all come together and turn these kind of these little bit tributaries I see beginning to form. Anti-war movement, the immigration thing that's been all over the news here this last week, and just kind of trying to point that forward towards the midterm elections that are coming up this year. What's going to go on in 2008? Is it going to be Hillary? Is it going to be John McCain, Feingold, whoever? Just maybe a beginning of some sort of something again. I'm 48 years old this year. I'd love to spend a lot of time with the Reverend here. He's evidently
you know, both of you folks go back. To me, it's such an honor just to sit down here with you because you were here when I was just a kid, when these images were just something on a TV set to a kid who was in 68, what, 10 years old or something. And it's a real honor to be a part of that, and I'd like to learn from you folks. And to me, when I go back and I read, I mentioned to Reverend Charlie earlier today, I went back just the other day for the first time in ages and reread Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech. This man was clearly, to me, there's been, you know, and once again, as a non-Christian, if you will, nobody has done a better job that I can see ever at melding that the Jesus of the Sermon of the on the Mount, you know, keeping his feet firmly planted here on earth, doing for what I guess for him was a Christian duty, and improving the quality of people's lives. I'm convinced he took a bullet for it. All right. But he was killed a year to the day, I think it was, that he gave that speech. But this, suffice it to say, it should be an inspiration for all of us, and we should be able to learn from it. I'd like to see this this burgeoning, this still largely nascent anti-war thing that's the gathering, you know, a little Cindy Sheehan, a little this, a little that, come into some sort of quiet storm, you know, where we can just let the other side, whatever you want to call them. Corporate types, George Bush. It's not all Republicans. There's a lot of really responsible Republicans who actually have been doing some of the, I think, doing the best anti-Bush polemics, certainly in the last couple of years. So, the point I'm trying to make is that there's a with the anti-war stuff, with the attack on constitutional liberties and civil rights, there's just so many opportunities for us to come together with some common ground and put aside, you know, issues that really don't need to be, you know, you don't want to try to address everything with every rally that you do. So I just like to be a part of it, do my thing. I'm thinking about, I told Heidi the other night, seriously going to China and teaching English for a year. And I can't think of anything that I'd rather be my last thing that I'm able to do in my home country than be a part of this before I do that. So I'd like to, Jim and I have had some, he's a big media guy. We've talked a lot about how we might best document this thing. He's already got plans for a DVD. He's already got a website up, another website. You know, this is apart from what, you know, all these other sites that everybody has up in Peace and Justice. And just to make the connections and not be afraid just to put one foot after the other. And, you know, where it leads, we don't know, but we just know we have to make the journey. All right, come on.
Hi, my name is Sunny Miller, and I'm here from Deerfield, and as I said, leaving tomorrow morning.
Deerfield.
Massachusetts, yes. On my mother's side of the family, my grandfather, Earl Townsley, lived mainly in White County, Indiana, and there, as I understand, there weren't beautiful brown-skinned people there, so as a member of the Ku Klux Klan, they harassed, I don't think they hurt their neighbors, but they at least harassed and degraded their Catholic neighbors. That was the form of discrimination prevalent in that county, White County, Indiana. And in my lifetime, I have to say, I am so grateful to celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday every year. Our celebrations in Massachusetts teach me so much. I learn more every year, and it starts my year with hope in hard times, real hope. We gather. This year, I really enjoyed seeing an old video about his work and learning new things. One of the things I need to go back for is... you know, in this march, partly we're working against the big corporate influences that want war. We all know that if we could take the money out of war, we'd end it. We would have no war. We might have some fisticuffs. But war has been for profit, and it's hurting us. And the war is coming home in beautiful little Vermont. You think of Vermont as one of those beautiful little New England states, right? Well, we have an old nuclear reactor, 34 years old, the oldest one in New England, owned by Entergy Corporation. based in Louisiana. They'll cut and run from any of their local holdings that have a problem, like they did in New Orleans, as I understand it, cutting and run from a power station there. They want to crank up this old nuclear reactor by 20%. The very first day they increased to 5%, they had vibration issues. I said, oh, no, that's not a problem. That's just a hum. They've gone up to 110%. And a colleague yesterday on her personal radiation monitor, as she was changing the batteries, got a reading of 400 counts per minute. She was shocked because the average would be more like 20 counts per minute, and where I live in Deerfield, more like 15 counts per minute. And this little Geiger tube in the monitor, the size of your baby finger, counting any radioactive event that passes through there of any type. And it went down 200, 100. So it was a brief reading. But all radioactive contamination is harmful to us. And there is no governmental ongoing radiation monitoring in all of Western Massachusetts. So I called MEMA, our little state, like FEMA agency, right? Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. I called a few weeks ago, how long would it take you to tell me what the radiation levels are right now in Deerfield? They said, well, in 1 to 2 hours, we could get somebody out there. Well, we're hoping and working hard to change that, to get radiation monitoring going on, and we need it everywhere, because here, we're downwind from something. Everywhere you travel in this country, you're downwind from something. And every time you go to a beautiful big river or a lake or the ocean, you know, there you are. It won't be on the map, and you might not know where it is, but it's there. So whether it's Entergy Corporation or ExxonMobil, I was very inspired by Reverend Malveaux, Roy Malveaux, who came up and spoke on Sunday, the very first day of the march, speaking very beautifully about standing up to the big corporation, ExxonMobil. They feel is responsible for 1,000 deaths in Beaumont. He talked about the soot on the roofs. You can wipe your hand across the shingles and just your hand will be black, the black lung, the liver cancer of a child 11 years old. These very unnatural things. So I hope in our circles that we accept that we are part of the problem, and that's why we're a part of the solution too. And I'm so grateful to have worked with Nick on the boycott. I got to amplify a cartoon that's on the ExxonMobil boycott bill, the democracy dollar that he's handing out so happily when he walks past every gas station he walks past. He's visiting with his neighbors and talking about this opportunity for us to exercise our power. And I understand, not only for Martin Luther King, but my dear neighbor who's passed on now, Wally Nelson, who was a civil rights activist helping advise Martin Luther King. Pardon me?
Is he from Arkansas?
Yeah.
Born in Arkansas, yes. Wally Nelson. And his
American Quaker?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if he's a Quaker. He lives...
When I first met him.
Yeah?
Yeah, he come from the Quaker movement. We'll talk more later.
Well, Wally, Wally taught us to not be afraid. And, he said, when he walked out of that CO camp during World War II, the gate wasn't locked, but it took courage. He said, I was shaking in my boots because he knew he was walking into prison. Five of them walked out of the CO camp. And for us to look at our opportunity and take it. And he said, the one thing I'm most afraid of probably is not being free. He lived it daily, just that loving freedom. So I'm so grateful to be here with you, exploring our freedom on the road, under the great sky, putting one step in front of the other, figuring out how we're going to do this differently as we turn away from the age of oil and nuclear power and see what other possibilities are before us.
Sarah Acker.
A teacher from Addison, Texas, which is North Dallas area. And I kind of knew Valley from before, And I knew that she was organizing this thing. And so I also saw Fahrenheit 9/11 a little while ago. And then that just made me start asking a lot of questions. And then once I started doing more, you know, researching into what was going on, it seemed that there was something really wrong with our government and with the way that they're profiting and engaged in such, you know, violent things over in Iraq. And I felt I needed to be a part of the march because, well, especially since it's in memory of Martin Luther King. You know, I wasn't around for that. But, you know, I read about it in the books, and we had just actually happened to have watched a movie called something Selma that was made, what was it called?
Well, the Black Sun, one Black Sun, it was.
No, but it was one, it was a movie like that where it was, actors, but it was made by Disney. Anyway, it was a historical film about his work in Selma, and we had just shown it to our kids because it was Black History Month, you know, and we're studying, everybody was studying a different, you know, famous, you know, person. And I just was, and like right after we watched the movie, I was watching the movie and I pulled up the, I was checking my email and I pulled up my email and I saw there's something from Valley and it showed up there and here's the flyer for March to Redeem. And I was like, I was looking over to the movie and then looking back over at the computer and I was like, whoa. And I was like, guess God's trying to tell me something. So then, you know, so then I took that opportunity as soon as we finished watching the movie to tell the students about what was going to be happening. And I was actually kind of nervous about it because we're taught, you know, not to tell that kind of stuff and not to talk about political things and religious things and sexual things and anything that could, you know,
possibly interesting,
right? And so...
Don't talk too much about the truth.
Right.
No, we don't talk that much about the truth
There's
at
no
all.
There's no money in that.
Yeah, so, and I am, again, I am in the minority, you know, in my school.
I can imagine, yeah.
And, I'm really, you know, vocal about it, so I'm just real open, you know, to dialogue with other people about what's going on. But anyways, so I just let them know, and the kids were really open and accepting, and they could obviously see the correlation between what we were doing and what Martin Luther King did, and they were just like, yeah, that's the same kind of thing. I mean, it's peace and freedom. That's what we want, you know. We want equal rights for people. That means people who are in Iraq. That means the soldiers. That means the immigrants. That means it's everybody, you know. Everybody is supposed to be equal here, and we're not. Mm-hmm. So we have to fight for that. And so that's basically the reason why I wanted to be a part of it. So I took off a few days and got a really good sub and came along.
Wow. Mm. You are truly dangerous. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm ready to speak, y'all. I would. Let's say. Before I even came along, Mr. Johnson dragged me along, and I ain't know what was going on. I thought I was going to do some in and out for him. But before I know it, I'm walking with y'all, you know, and learning. And I like what y'all talking about. It's better y'all doing instead of just talking about it. Mm-hmm. Instead of most people just, all they do is talk about it, look at the news. Y'all actually doing it, so I'm learning. All right, y'all, I'm kind of shy.
Go to me. That's right.
What is your name? What is your name for?
Zig.
Zig.
Okay, Zig. Okay, my name is Ann Cohn, and I'm from Richardson. And I came here kind of a circular route. Cindy Sheehan kind of triggered my interest last August and September, and Crawford, and then the Peace March in Washington, D.C., which I have a lot of fun on, scooting around on my scooter. And as far as Martin Luther King, I get emotional about things. I wear my emotions on my sleeve. And we just had a proposition to, in November, I'm gay. I'm with Stonewall Democrats. And when I listen to Martin Luther King's speeches on civil rights, and I know he's talking about gay rights too, and that's very big for me, because that's where I'm coming from. And he saw that, and very, very few people back then saw that. And you know, I listened to his words, and people nowadays don't even see that. But back then, I mean, it's revolutionary. And he was so far ahead of his time. Vietnam, and the correlation between Iraq and that speech at the church, that anti-war speech. He understood. And we have to learn. And the people nowadays I don't know if they've forgotten or if they never learned it. But history is the way we do learn. And otherwise, we're just constantly making those same mistakes. And we're making those mistakes right now. And we're paying a terrible price. And the world is paying a terrible price for our mistakes. And we have to teach the children, the young people now, because they're the ones who are going to be taking on everything in the future. And it's going to be so much worse if they don't learn. So we have to make enough noise and enough impact right now. And I was so encouraged by the kids' immigration right now triggering. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, oh, wow, you know, things, maybe, you know, it's hopeful. It was very hopeful to me. And but I'm here to try and I can't walk. I don't walk, but I told them I'd put Band-Aids on their blisters. I'm a retired nurse, so that I can do. But my legs won't let me walk. But I'm here to do what I can, and I really appreciate learning from all you people, because you're, and you too, Z. Hey, all right.
I'm going to jump in, even though I'm not really sitting at the table like you said. Lon Burnham, and many of you know that in that world out there, I wear two different hats. One is a state representative representing an inner city district in Fort Worth, and the other is director of the Dallas Peace Center. And, you know, every person that has spoken, I thought, oh, I got to say this, I got to say that. I really would like to talk later. But at the same time, my situation is Martin Luther King and my father were both born in 29, and relatively closely together birthday-wise. So I've always used that as kind of a comparison. And some of you know, he's real sick, so I've got to go pretty quick because I've left him with a healthcare provider. But I'm going to share one point of reference. This button is just simply King's portrait, and it says, "Fulfill the Dream." I've had this button since about 92 or 93, and I always wear it on King's birthday because we don't want to celebrate the death. We want to celebrate the life and the birth. And I just think our celebrations at King's birthday in North Texas are pretty shallow. And a lot of people at this table have been involved in talking about how do we deepen that dialogue and conversation. So I'm glad you said what you said about that. And so this is just my little thing that I do every MLK weekend for 14 years now at least, is to wear this button that just says, "Fill the Dream." And I'm going to go in a minute, but go ahead.
Hi, I'm William Jones from Austin, Texas, and I heard about this march from a friend of mine, Karen, at a party, and Karen Haddon. Yeah, our friend Karen Haddon. And I wanted to come on this march because it would allow me to be introduced to new ideas and different points of view. And it would be a story that I could tell people down the road.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
literally.
Yeah.
I was slow.
Yeah.
Oh, don't worry. Yeah. And I think that I am representing kids my age. I'm 16. And most kids nowadays would, if they heard about this march, would ask, "Why are you trying to do this? I don't understand." And I think the reason for that is when they listen to Dr. King, they think what his speeches amount to are in the past. And they don't put two and two together and see the symbology and the true meaning in his speeches that go out to the common person through all time. And you know, it really frustrates me because I used to go to school and kids just do not care.
You play with the cord and make static.
Oh, sorry. Okay. And, you know, they just, I don't know really if it's because their parents didn't care and their grandparents were taught not to care. But ultimately, it's their decision, and they're not seeing it that way. They're just making the system out to be the bad guy, and that it's still repressing them when really they could control the system when they vote in a few years. And, you know, I try telling them that, but I don't know what's with them. You probably do, personally. And, you know, I still have friends who are teachers in my old school, Travis High School, and they're still there because they want to reach out to the good kids and educate them more and at least try to give the bad acting kids at least something to listen to and make them second guess their ways. And I respect them for that. But, you know.
You're being
on stage. No, I'm being on stage. Wow. It's okay. I think ultimately in 10 years, you know, there are going to be people coming out, you know, saying that it is their time and they can take over the world if they wanted to for the better. And I don't necessarily think it's going to be my generation, but probably the one who's in grade school right now, most likely, because I've noticed that most of them do care more than people my age for some reason. And hopefully, you know, my generation will catch up more. That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I'm the subject. I'm the objective media right here.
Fair and balanced.
Fair and balanced.
Okay.
My name is Nathan Diebenow. I'm with the Lone Star Iconoclast. We endorsed Kerry in the 2004 election. We were out of Crawford, Texas, which is the new Germany. the new Nazi Germany.
That's right.
We're still kind of doing the same, which is not good, but we're getting read a lot more, which is all the support we need to continue. Any kind of recognition is good, which is why I'm here, to give you guys recognition for what you're doing. And on the way down here, I just kept thinking about when I heard that Martin Luther King and Casey Sheehan died on the same day. And I heard that the first, when Hadi was awarded at the Dallas Peace Center along with Johnny Wolfe, Peacemaker of the Year. And that gave me shivers. That really did. But what gave me even more shivers was that Casey Sheehan was born a day after me, May 29th. I was born on May 28th, same year. And I haven't really figured out what that means yet, and been racking my brain, because it's such a good, weird thing to write about for a personal column, of course. But I'm still mulling that over. Since our endorsement, a couple things have happened in my life. One was, started off with a phone call like the week of our endorsement, and the guy called me up on the phone and was like, I was at work, and he's like, why did you guys do that to Bush? And I'm like, it was the right thing to do. And he's like, aren't you Christians? And I said, I didn't really think that had anything to do with it, sir. And I thought, and he's like, oh, I think it did. And I don't remember what happened after that. I guess I hung up on him. I don't know. But I thought about it later, and I was thinking, well, maybe it really does. Maybe it really does matter. But he was wrong. Yeah. This guy on the phone was wrong. And so since then, I kind of got more into my own Lutheran theology. I'm a pastor's kid, so you know, there's really nothing new about rabble rousing in our group. You know, we're always going against the grain and making trouble. So I just got more deep into that and got into Luther's writings. And the big thing with him was the theology of the cross versus the theology of glory. And it seems like America has its own theology, and that's the theology of America. That's America's number one, and everyone else is, you know, number zero. And you know, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter what, you know, economic system we're in. It doesn't matter what political party is in power. If we think that we're better than anyone, then we've totally missed the reason why Jesus died on the cross. I mean, it's just totally, you know, it was the whole Sermon on the Mound. It was the same thing with Gandhi was talking about, and he wasn't even Christian. You know,
better Christian than most Christians I know.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and then a little later on, I got into reading about white privilege and about what it means to be a white American or anybody with fair skin in today's world, and that really scares the living shit out of me. To think that. Mm-hmm. I have been socialized to think that I am the standard by which everyone else should live up to.
New Babylon.
Say what?
You're the new Babylon.
Yeah. And
you get that?
No, I get that.
You know what happened to it? Okay.
Yeah. And so I'm here to work against that, I guess. To make it more level playing field. And I'm struggling. It's tough. It really is. So that's where I am today.
I need that. Yeah.
Well, my name is Richard Wayne, and my friend Gordon and I came down from DeSoto. Some days it seems like I'm privy to every liberal progressive mailing list in the world. I'm not really sure how I learned about this, but I think through the Dallas Peace House, and I like the label, the words for the march for redemption of the soul of America. I think that really reflects what Dr. King was trying to teach us, that we were very much in jeopardy of going on the wrong path, of losing our souls, of losing our goodness. And I think to a large extent America has. We've been the beacon, the light of the world for so many years, and that's very debatable whether we still are that beacon. If we are, then things are in pretty sorry shape. But I think the march to redeem the soul of America, that is really a compelling label for me, because I almost see that we're on the brink of darkness, and that we could go one path or go the other, and we've really been on the wrong path. And furthermore, I wake up every morning wondering why people aren't marching in the streets, why we're not taking to the streets and vocalizing our anger and our frustration with the way our leaders are conducting this country, and they've really brought a lot of shame and disgrace to our country. And I don't really understand why people aren't getting up every morning and just shouting, we're not going to take this anymore. So although this is our visit to you all, we're not involved in the march. Our prayers are with you, and we really do wish you well and support you. You're doing a great thing. This is what people need to be doing. This is what Americans need to be doing, is getting out, marching, taking to the streets, vocalizing. A couple of things that I'm very proud of that I've done in the last year. I organized a protest. Karl Rove visited Dallas a few months ago, so I organized a protest, and we were just across the street from Union Station, a bunch of us. There was about 30 people showed up, and we had banners, and we were chanting, and although a number of news organizations covered us, I never did find any trace that we existed, other than various websites.
Belo's right there. How dare
Belo, right. We had some big names there, but it didn't make any of them. And it was a pretty dull time news-wise, so that was a very educational experience for me as well. But I'm proud that we did that. We stood across the street, and we got a few gestures from people here and there. But it was a constructive experience. Another thing that I've been doing is writing a lot of op-eds for the Dallas County Democratic Party website and talking about national, state, local issues. Something that I'm particularly distressed about is just the extreme level of apathy. I have three sons, 17, 21, and 24. And when I was young, of course, during the Vietnam War in the 60s and 70s, young people, perhaps because of the draft, were a lot more energized and active and engaged. It's so hard to find people who are engaged. In Dallas County, 2.8% people came out to vote in the primaries a couple of weeks ago. There was a special election in Grand Prairie that the governor called, and a total of 7.8% of the population came out and voted. 7.8% of the population. We were going door to door making phone calls, and still just 7.8% of the people came out and voted. And it seems particularly young people are apathetic and just sort of isolated from the issues and not engaged. That's very disturbing to me. That, I think, is the secret sort of recipe that if we can engage the young people, like Howard Dean may have a little, we have some chance. But that's particularly distressing. And so I guess in conclusion, I think it's very admirable, and we're very grateful for what you all are doing, marching. And we are thinking about you. And hopefully activities like this and others, we can try and engage our very apathetic citizenry, especially the young people, more over time.
My name is Jim Goodenow from Tulingua, Texas, and I have the honor of driving a rather large peace bus, the Yellow Rose of Texas, try to see where the lateness comes out of it. And from what's going down with us all, there is a lot of lateness, there's a lot of innovation, there's a lot of new things going down. We're kind of pushing the envelope, and we're going over the edge, and we're testing some new territories for me in all the years I've been into activism as it is. And I just sort of am really inspired by the lovely portraits of the board of directors that we have here in this church at this time. And
we haven't brought them in here, you know. They have to listen outside the way we all.
Well, okay, yeah, they probably come in here and bug us. It reminds me of Mobile to New Orleans, March. I had a chance to do a little brainstorming. I talked with Cindy and her sister Dee Dee, and we were thinking along the lines of what's going down with the thing with ExxonMobil here. And all the good things that Nick has put together on that aspect. So I asked Cindy, and we're in this park there coming into New Orleans. I said, would she be willing to have a Camp Casey in front of the CEOs and the top corporate executives of the war profiteering corporations of this nation? These are the men and women, folks, that live in Pound Ridge, New York, Scarsdale. They live out in Arlington, I guess, around here, Palm Beach, you name it, Bel Air, you know, Huntington Beach, and they've got these humongous mansions and all kinds of security gates, just like the president does.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. But she said she would be very open to it. And I think we ought to take it to them, and in a way, not really. Well, you know, I want their children to say, "Mommy, Daddy, how come these people are on our front lawn?" And have them explain how come we have so many dead children their age that are beneath the ground if they got a burial in Iraq. We're the ones who will die over the eons of years now from the depleted uranium. Yes, folks, there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there still are. It's ours, depleted uranium. It's a whole other topic. I don't have time to get into it. I'm going to pass it on. Thank you. Yeah.
I'm Gail Dunkelberger, and I'm touched to be here. I as I'm listening to all of the stories, even before I heard any of the stories, I just knew that there was such an electric, energetic, amazing feeling of bonding. Because, I mean, to realize that people are on a 14-day march or any part of a 14-day march, and these people who've been coming every day, that's a real commitment. I mean, we've all been in meetings where we plan a march or we plan a vigil or we have people come on a monthly basis to a peace meeting. But to be in a group like this where people have really put themselves out to this extent to participate in an activity like this, you know already just that they're here at this Formica table that they're very, we're all bonded. Even though some we just met tonight, it's just it's a very emotional thing. And it's an evening that I know I will never forget. I don't know how much you have an opportunity to come together around a table like this with people this committed, but I mean, I've met Jim and knowing the effort you put in and you hearing your stories, Ina, right? Ina?
Yes, you have heard the last time. I thought you were on the plane, they get me right now. they did me so bad I had to write to them. I mean, it was terrible, and I'm handicapped. I got on them. I mean, I can't go nowhere. If I get on a plane, they're going to get me.
And you don't seem intimidated about that one single bit.
I got them told I do good when I get them told.
but Valley, I know the work that she's put in, and Hottie too. And your name,
Tom.
That's right. I remember meeting you before, and I think I asked you twice before. I'll remember it this time. But you know your story too. I know that you've been really involved with this, And I when I met Sunny the first right away, I want to say about especially Sunny, but everybody. I remember once about 30 years ago meeting. It was during the Vietnam War, and I met a couple from India, and we talked and we got to know them well enough to visit back and forth, and we talked about politics and we talked about racism and. And I realized right away that I felt like this woman should be my sister. And I have a sister that I love dearly, but our politics are not the same. And it really makes such a strange difference when you meet people like this. If you think about your relatives, your blood relatives, that are not anywhere on the same wavelength as you on these matters, and these matters are so important to us, so it only stands to reason that I feel so much more like this is my family, this is who I should be having Thanksgiving dinner with every day. But
why not?
Yeah. Right. But and to meet Sarah, who's taken off from school, and her presence alone must have impressed her principal to say, yeah, go, because not too many principals would do that. So there's something going on behind Sarah's whole history for that to have occurred. And Zig gives Peter credit for his being here. And I'm sure that Peter was the catalyst. But Zig, there's a lot going on behind that white cap of yours to have brought you this. Keep coming back. I don't think Peter has you in shackles. And I've been, that just impresses me so much. And I've gotten to know Anne a little bit. And I feel like she's my sister. And to see, I consider you one of the young people, Sarah, but you and Zig and William, that just really gives me heart. To know that there are a few young people, and it's, you know, when we went to that march and on the vigil on the 18th, and the girl stood up and right. and she made a little speech. It was on a rally to commemorate the third anniversary.
The invasion.
And tears were going down her cheeks, and she must have been, 20 something. And her, it was just like William, her lament, she says, I'm so ashamed of the bulk of my peers because nobody is doing anything. And we were all, median age of 70 to death. And she said, you people are just amazing. And yet to see William and Zig and Sarah coming on this march day after day and just sweating out there in the hot sun, my goodness. It's really, I will never forget that, especially being here and being able to talk about it. And Nathan standing out there in the hot sun, too. Every one of
it's
you,
my
I mean.
Privilege.
And, just knowing that Richard is here, I just met him half an hour ago, and already I feel we should be getting together every Christmas and every Thanksgiving, and
there you go,
and of course Jim and Peter. Yeah, I that's just what I wanted to say. I also want to say one or two things about the name of the march, Redeemed a Soul, the March to Redeem the Soul of America. I liked that name right off, and Nick Collins said that's what they decided to name it. And I said it to somebody who isn't particularly involved, but was interested, and as someone who's involved in the movement, caring about the movement. And I think I'm not sure who it was, and this person said, "Gee, I didn't know America ever had a soul." And I felt, well, that was sort of a put down. But there's something to say about that. You think maybe the pilgrims, but then once we got here, what we did to the American Native Americans and what we done to the slavery that lasted 250 years. Most of you probably saw that movie by Michael Moore, Bowling for Columbine, where he did the little cartoon where it just, and it's a strange way to see it, but the violence all the way through, that's kind of chilling when you really, he did it in a funny way, but if you stop and realize, it's a cartoon about violence from the beginning till now, and so maybe if we think about the pilgrims actually coming over on the Mayflower, although we don't like to think about the Daughters of America taking over that name, but to go back to the very first concept of freedom, coming to this country for freedom, let's try to redeem that soul. When I had my third son was born in 1970, And my first two sons, my husband named, and he named them after people in his family. And so I thought, well, this is my third son, and this is probably, he's going to be the last, and I'm going to name this one. And we named him Benjamin Martin Dunkelberger. And Benjamin was for Benjamin Spock, and Martin was for Martin Luther King. And one of my neighbors said, you should write to them both and tell them what you did. And so I did, and Martin Benjamin Spock, of course, is still alive, and he wrote back and said, I loved your letter. What I wrote to him is, I said, I promise I won't proselytize my son, and I won't try to be preachy about what his names were for, and let him grow up naturally and make his own decisions. And so he just wrote back. He said, I loved your letter. And the letter for Martin Luther King, we wrote to Coretta Scott King, and she wrote back, we always appreciate, though we're so happy that others appreciate a life well lived. And I've had that letter Xeroxed a lot because my son did grow up to really appreciate his name, and he takes these Xeroxes and passes them out to people. So I guess we didn't turn him against all the good things.
Yeah. Mm.
grandfather's Andrew Jackson.
Okay.
Andrew Jackson.
Oh my goodness, what'd you say?
And what happened, you know, they advertised, and the master named him Andrew Jackson, the seventh president of the United States, who was a notorious Indian hater and slave killer.
Yeah.
And for years, you use the name AJ rather than Andrew Jackson. And let me tell you what happened. This is just, I just got to tell it. After the Civil War, they had a bank. And the newly freed slaves, they already had some that were freed. And the newly freed slaves had the bank, the Freedmen's Bank, put money in the bank, and do you know they stole every penny of it. And the Mormons, who thought the blacks were heathens, you know who the heathens are, don't you? Mm-hmm. Okay. Got the guys in prison who were intelligent. They went into the archives, and they got 450,000 names of the blacks, of the slaves, newly free slaves, and slaves. And guess what I found? A.J. Hurdle. That's my grandfather. Never got a penny. Never got a penny. They stole every penny of it, you hear me? From the blacks. Mm-hmm. All right, the next thing, I'm going to be quiet just a minute, but let me tell you this. At the end of the Civil War, the Bank of New York City consigned Reconstruction money for the South. It was to go into New Orleans. They had a hurricane. And the ship went down. And it sailed into international waters, okay? Now, there is a company, the Odyssey Company, Marines Company. With new technology, guess what? They got that gold and silver. And they carried it to New Orleans. So I was getting ready to go to church, and there it is. I said, this is something else. For the reconstruction of the South, which included the 4 acres and the mule for an education for, you know, the new free slaves. They got all that money. And when the hurricane came, I got the information. They got out of there with all of that gold and silver from New Orleans right now. So the person who interviewed them, it was on Ted Koppel. I saw it. They had it everywhere. Oprah went for everyone. Whose money is this? So the lady said, didn't some of that money belong to the slaves? One word, yes. Oprah Winfrey didn't say anything. I don't know if she doesn't know history, but I've taught history for 44 years, so I know my history. But anyway, I still think some of that money belongs to her. Yeah. They got out of New Orleans during this last hurricane, every penny intact. I got it. Peter, that's a project for you.
That's what I need.
International waters, too. See, you wouldn't have to go through the United States. You'd have to go through... international waters, okay? Can't get it from the United States.
First, we want to thank everybody just for being here. My name is Peter Johnson, and I am proud to say that I am 61 years old, and I joined the Civil Rights Movement when I was 13. And the reason Z is so important to me is because some black men took an interest in me when I was a kid and made me go to class, took my gun from me, because I was going to kill a white man, made me be a good student, and kept me out of trouble. And those black men were Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King and Andrew Young. And I grew up literally at the feet of Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy. Ralph married me and my wife. On his dying bed, he told me that I had a special responsibility because I was the youngest one. And Ralph told me if God would bless me, I would probably outlive all of them. Now, all of those men are in their late 70s and early 80s now. And they're passing off this scene. So for me, it is important that we continue to work to fulfill Dr. King's dream. This is a very sacred day for me.
Me too.
on the morning of April 4th, 1968, we had breakfast with Dr. King in Memphis. And we had fish and grits. And it was a very troubling time because we had literally lost control of the streets of Memphis. And we had never had a demonstration in our history at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference where we lost control of a demonstration. We always took pride in the fact that we controlled and kept all of our protests very peaceful. And this had never happened to us before. And there was a lot of internal struggle inside the civil rights movement at that time. And this last breakfast with Dr. King that April 4th morning was very troubling because he was going through a lot of internal conflicts in his own psyche. And he'd done some strange and unusual things that he had never done before. He made staff assignments. Dr. King never made, I never knew him to make staff assignments. Andrew Young, who was his title was executive director of SCLC. He made the staff assignments because he was more aware of who had what ability and capabilities and skills. And Andy would make the decisions on who was going to go where and at what time and what they would do. Dr. King, that morning, made staff assignments, and most of the younger men who were considered kind of hot-headed was reassigned outside of it, outside of Memphis. I was sent to upper state New York, up to Rochester, to make a speech to Jews to raise money. This is something I had never done before. And not only that, people who knew me very well knew I couldn't be trusted to do something like that because I could go up there and curse them out. You know, I just turned 23. Like Z, you know, Dr. King was killed on April 4th. I turned 23 on March 19th. So, I was extremely young, and that was what Martin Luther King called a new militancy in the young men on his staff. So this is a very, very sacred day for me, and it's made more painful because of the loss of Coretta King and Mrs. Parks these past couple of months. This has been a very, very difficult period for me personally. Rosa Parks was very special to me. I have a button on the day. She was very special to me. So was Coretta King. I took 25 people to Mrs. King's funeral with me, and Anna was one of them, and of course I invited Nick, but also I asked Heidi and Valerie to attend this funeral with me. I have a hidden agenda, and my hidden agenda is that we've got to figure out a way how to put our movements back together. What has happened to us over the last 35 to 40 years is that the peace movement has the peace movement, the environmental movement has the environmental movement, the gay and lesbian has the gay and lesbian movement. We have all of these separate, unrelated, independent causes. What made the 60s great is there was one big human rights struggle against warfare, against violence, against materialism, and against the atrocities of the South, segregation and racism. Ben Spark was our friend. And Ben Spark participated in civil rights movements, the civil rights movement, just as we participated in the anti-war movement. We never did, that was a tremendous personal relationship that existed. We knew each other because we worked together, whether it was on the dusty roads in Mississippi or in front of the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. Our movements were united, and that's what made us effective and strong. So my hidden agenda is, and the reason I am here, is we've got to figure out a way how to put our struggles back together, because as the people in Beaumont in South Texas are poisoned by ExxonMobil, ExxonMobil is perpetuating warfare in the desert. There's a relationship between our suffering. and we've got to figure out a way to put this together. So I am a part of this, and God knows I am very, very tired. I am tired of marching. I'm tired of picketing. I'm tired of going to jail. You know, I'm tired of being poor. But I know I have a special responsibility, because this precious legacy that Dr. King has left for us, those of us who are left here have a responsibility to not just keep it alive, but to try to hand it down to Z and to William. William was only 16 years old. You know, William, when I was 16, I was driving Martin Luther King around and carrying his luggage and polishing his shoes and stealing his brandy.
Oh, mercy.
Let me tell you one story about that. And I was a little older. Yeah. I was a little older. We were in Birmingham, but Dr. King was going to preach at a church somewhere outside of Birmingham one Sunday, and I was going to drive him. And it may be 20 or 30 miles outside of Birmingham at a little church he was going to preach at. And when we had rented a station wagon, and we were staying at a black motel called Gaston's Motel, which was owned by Mr. Gaston. At that time, he was the richest black man in America. And I had kept the station wagon that night and gone out with some other fellows who were a little older than me, but still young, you know, Jesse Jackson and Julian Bond and John Lewis. And we were all students, but they were a little older than me. And I had literally had too much to drink. And that morning when I picked Dr. King up from at the hotel, because we were late, and he was fussing at me because we were late. And I was standing there listening to him and feeling awfully, awfully bad. So I all of a sudden, I just threw up all over his little new suit. Oh.
Oh, God. I like mercy.
Mercy. You won't ever forget that moment.
Yeah.
Let me share something else.
What did he do to you?
He had a fit. I threw up on his suit. I mean, we were already late getting to this church. You know. Oh no, he had to go upstairs and change clothes.
Okay.
You know, and he ended up wearing blue jeans to that church.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fishing grits in there?
Yeah. Now, but let me share something with you about him that a lot of people don't know. He had this wonderful, wonderful sense of humor. Everybody see him as this very serious, great theologian, this deep philosophical thinking man. Dr. King could tell you some of the most foul, vulgar jokes you ever want to hear. You know, Coretta used to always say, "Martin, don't tell them boys them nasty jokes," because Dr. King could say some of the most vulgar jokes that you ever heard. I used to always wonder where he get them from, you know.
Someone. Pass the legacy on.
He was a big prankster. He played jokes on people. And he was always playing jokes, especially on us who were young. One year we were coming back from the Quakers gave Dr. King a bus that he called a Freedom Burst because it was always broke, and we were coming back on the Freedom Burst one night from somewhere, and we had a bloody day. I don't remember where, but we were on our way back to Atlanta, and the students, we were in the back of the bus. We had a couple of guitars and some bongo drums, and we were doing what students do, cutting up and making noise and dancing and playing music. And the senior men were sitting way up at the front of the bus, and the bus was full. And Daddy King, Dr. King's father, we call him Daddy King, was at the front of the bus also, at the very front of the bus. And every now and then, Daddy King would stand up and turn around and scream something back to the back to us, which we really could not hear because there was a lot of noise, people talking in the bus, making noise, because it was an elderly, you know, the whole bus making noise, and the bongo drums and the guitars and the dancing and the singing. So Dr. King gets up, walks back to the back of the bus and says, "Hey, Dad says for y'all to play a little louder so he can hear." So we really got the plane then, you know. And of course, about 5 minutes later, Daddy King got up, walked back there and gave us a good talk and just snatched the guitar out of my hand. And of course, Marty up at the front of the bus almost falling on the floor laughing. we have a great challenge before us. And that challenge is to redeem the soul of America. That was Martin Luther King's motto when he established the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. His motto was to redeem the soul of America. And he believed that America had a collective soul.
That's true.
And that what he called men and women of goodwill has a responsibility to help America redeem her soul. And this responsibility has fallen in our laps. When you look at the history of the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, what you see is thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Those pictures are the results of small groups like this, working very hard, groups who were, you know, focused on a mission and refused to give up and was very persistent and kept on pushing and pushing until we made it happen. When you look at the student movements in the 60s, there was a handful of students on college campuses trying to do these things. And gradually it grew and it grew and grew. It did not start with tens of thousands of students. Nor did the civil rights movement or the peace anti-war movement start with tens of thousands of people. There is a coma in America that the American citizenry is trapped in this coma. Our responsibility is to figure out a way to wake them up. We have to fix these problems for the next generation. The problems of racism and bigotry and violence and warfare. Every year on April 4th, I usually have a gun buyback in the southern sector. But this year we changed our gun buyback because I wanted to be a part of this. And we're going to do the gun buyback sometime in June. But we do these things to keep Dr. King's legacy alive, but to give us a chance to discuss the issues of violence in our society. The whole question of homophobia in Black America has to be confronted. And we've got to be wise enough and strong enough to take the abuse and to stand up for everybody's right. These are challenging times for us. But every time somebody's child is sent home from Iraq in a coffin, it should wake somebody up in America. And we should not allow this to happen in the dark, but shine light on this. It seems that we've worked out an arrangement next week for Dr. Joseph Lowry and Martin Luther King III to join us on this march, and to march into Crawford with us and to be with us over the Easter holiday. These things must happen because we must unite our movements. There cannot be a separate movement for justice in America and a separate movement for peace and a separate movement for the rights of homosexuals and a separate movement for immigrants. This problem, you know, Dr. King used to say when he first told us we were going to organize poor people in America and go to Washington, and he talked about sending some of us up to Appalachia to organize poor whites. Well, you know, we said, well, Dr. King, why in the hell would we want to do that? You know, why would we want to do that? And he said, because the same dog that bit poor whites in Appalachia bit us in Mississippi, you see. And the same oppressor who oppresses gay people oppresses us. The same oppressor who want poor Hispanic people to go back to Mexico is the same oppressor who oppresses us. The same corporations who make dollars off of warfare are the same corporations who oppress us and who oppress women. So the same dog that bit us bit you. This is why we must face these most difficult times together. we had an opportunity to go to South Dallas and eat at the South Dallas Cafe. And I was very happy that you all agreed to do this, because there must be a visible presence of anti-war people in black communities. This cannot be done just in white communities. You know, we must have a visible appearance in all of the communities. As the days unfold, I am convinced that people will begin to join us the closer we get to Crawford. And I'm looking forward to what Thursday night in Hillsborough, Texas. I think that Valerie Reed has done a very good job in working without any resources to make this happen. And Valerie, you're an amazing organizer, a little bossy and pushy. So thank you all very much for coming and being a part of this. As we shed tears,
good.
And get soul feet and soul legs, you know, that's, you know, characterizing all that your deep commitment to peace, you know.
I would like to say this. I understand this is the 21st century, okay? New technology is what's going to do it, baby. Those kids organized with technology. And this is what we're going to have to harness, a way to get everybody involved. And don't worry, it's coming. However, whether I like it or you like it, don't worry, sister. It's going to be three borders, and they're going to be wide open. It's already done. Let me say this, brother. All you have to do is figure out what you want with numbers. It's already to make it. It's already done. I'm sorry. And some things going to have to be cut off, and we're going to have to keep focused. I'm not saying you've got to keep focused, but you're going to have to find a way and use new technology. That's the only way we're going to do this, is new technology. Listen, even as we're speaking right now, do you know somebody got this out, what we're saying tonight? Do you know that?
Oh, I'm sure they do.
They know sure too. I know what I'm talking about. I know exactly what I'm talking about, and it's prophecy, baby. Okay. Whether I like it or you like it, it's on its way. It's on its way. Sister, don't worry about it. It's going to come. I hope it comes in our lifetime.
Yeah.
Now, see, I hope it comes in our lifetime. But it's on its way, baby, and they know it.
Isn't it already happening in this room?
Tell me about it.
Right now.
Right now.
In
that's
this
right.
room.
That's
right.
Right.
Now.
That's right.
This
it's
is the
here.
Family.
This is it. This is it. It's happening.
This is the life we
now,
chose to
this
live.
This is it right here. That's right.
This is the family where
this
you reach
it.
Out.
That's
we're
right.
brother and sister.
This is it.
Right
and
now.
It's going to happen. I'm sorry. It's going to happen. And I'm sorry to say this. It's going to be the very rich, no middle class, and the very poor. Two classes. Brother, what has happened today has happened before. There is nothing new under the sun except to this generation. New technology, that's the wave of the future. You better get, email. That's how we don't talk. We email one another. You see what I mean? And when we do, that's dangerous too, but we got to keep up the conversation because they got us. They got us right now. And if somebody in this room, they got us, baby.
Oh, I know. You know, I was told last week by friends up in Washington, D.C. at the ACLU in Washington that they've just got a list of people who've, that I guess they've been keeping an eye on. And they told me, Peter, that your name on the list twice.
Like the song, I want to be in that number.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
I take it as
list.
A badge of honor, you know.
Absolutely, we all are on that list, and it is all honor.
Hey, so he's here.
I can't follow that. I'm just proud to actually be
accidentally been here. Right?
And actually, so much history so much has gone before, and you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, movements have to get together to one, because they do speak to the same place, the same message. And I've seen more and more of that, and I'm frustrated as well. I wish there were a lot more people standing up and saying, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. But we have to take that to them and make them understand why they need to be saying that. I'm concerned because I feel like that even not just the young people, but people who went through the 60s and the 70s as a young person, who went through Vietnam as a young person, have kind of lost that and given that spark away or let it die out or something, and are willing to sit back and say, whatever the powers that be are saying must be true. And when they're telling us that day is night and night is day,
right,
there's something wrong when we're going along with that. And that seems to be what's happening, and it's just got to stop. And we have the power to do it, whether we're using new technology or old technology. We still have the power to do it, and these kind of things will accomplish that. And the more people that raise their voice a little bit and say, this is enough, and start talking to their neighbors, I have the same problem you do in my family. My brother and I are so politically opposite that we can't even talk about it because we get too upset with each other. And that's a shame, but you feel like sometimes when you speak to groups like this that you're preaching to the choir in, but that's okay because your choir is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. The more people that you talk to, and
they energize us.
It keeps you going, keeps that hope alive, exactly. And and the more we keep Dr. King's memory alive, I think the better off we'll all be, frankly, because we haven't had anybody like him in this country. And we need somebody like that to kind of show us the way. But,
I disagree. I think we're all like him.
Well,
I
can't say that I am. I don't know that I would risk my life the way he did.
Well, you are right
now.
The way
that you did.
I'll tell you are right now.
That's right.
So get used to it.
Is this thing on? Yeah, but I didn't stand in front of the dogs and the police and the fire hoses. I wasn't willing to do that. And I don't know that I am right now. But,
new technology, got you, brother.
I'm well aware that, you know, if they want to listen to what I have to say, they'd listen. But I don't care.
That's attitude.
That's fine. Yeah. You know, if they want to listen to me, if they want to bore themselves with my conversation, that's fine with me. And being taped, that's fine. We should be more willing to say things in public and say things that we believe in public, and so that people can hear that that is a risk, but it's a smaller risk than I think some people were taking in those days. People that stand up, like, Cindy Sheehan, frankly, people who confront people, like Michael Moore, who goes in front of, senators and congressmen and says, here, your son and daughters are eligible, they're of age, they can join, sign them up right here, and confront people like that, and confront people with the reality of what is going on. And it just breaks my heart to hear mothers and fathers talking on the radio about just losing a son or daughter in Iraq, and for no reason other than to put some money into people's pockets.
Mm-hmm. You know, since some years ago, I think it was Dr. C.T. Vivian said that, and you're right that in terms of Dr. King and men like Dr. King are prophets.
That's right.
and what will become of a society who kills its prophets.
Exactly.
Yeah. Prophets show us the way that we should go, and they are men who are inspired by God. And you know, when America shot its prophets down, and we are like a lost ship at sea, you know, without a captain, without a rudder, without a sense of direction. So we have all of these profiteers and false prophets, like President Bush, who speaks about compassion and speaks about his religion and orders people to be bombed. I mean, and don't even understand the glaring contradiction.
Exactly.
You know, and there'll be other prophets that'll come along, but I think America as a society must pay for some of our sins. Dr. King said to Harry Belafonte 2 days before he was killed that he said, you know, I don't know whether or not what I have done is right because I have brought our people into be integrated into the American society and the House of America is on fire. And Harry asked him, well, Dr. King, what should we do? And Dr. King said, we ought to become firemen and help put the fires out. Which I think it was very profound on his part to understand that America's house is on fire. But as opposed to condemning it, he said we ought to work to put it out. Mm-hmm. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing as activists, one thing we should also keep in mind, especially when we get to be despairing about the lack of numbers that are not supporting us, we should remember that there was only one Rosa Parks. It was just one woman who knew what she had to do. She knew she had to do the right thing. And as long as I am thinking that I have to do what is right as an individual, then I really don't have to worry about whether 1,000 people are supporting me or 10,000 people are supporting me, as long as I am doing what I think that needs to be done.
And millions of people are hearing about this. What this group
that should not even enter my imagination or my thinking, because I just need to do what I'm supposed to be doing, which I know very clearly, and I should get up and do that every day. And you know, I'm like Sister, she says, you know, it's happening already, because someday this train is going to crash and people will come out of that wreckage of the train, and I need to be present enough in my mind to help those people do the right thing.
Right.
We'll have to rebuild this someday. We will have to rebuild this whole thing.
See,
not maybe in my life, maybe in my children's life or my grandchildren's life, but this has to be passed on, that we might have to start from scratch someday, and we know which way to go.
The evolution of the New World Order, that's what it is. This is what it is.
I just throw up this, you know, I don't want to do this, is so great. We could be here all night, but just so many great things have been going on. There's a story about, I'll keep this brief, follow up on what Hadi, through our comments, you guys were making the last couple of minutes. There's a famous scene where, I think it's during after the Tet Offensive, you can do a Google on it, I always qualify my statements with that. The way I remember it was LBJ's having his thing with the War Cabinet, the Army Chiefs of Staff, and they're talking about what's the next move in Vietnam. And he points across the White House lawn to the protesters, and something to the effect of, the thrust of the essay was, as it was kind of a post game of the Vietnam War era. Were you effective? How can you say you were effective? You know, prove to me you were effective. You know, could you have done this or done that? The case he was making was they were watching every move. You know, he had on good authority. The LBJ pointed across the lawn and said, see those people? They're going to come over that fence with a goddamn rope if I do what you've asked me to do. Do you want that? So they were, you know, they're keeping a poker face, right? I think it's a little easier now to see. In this information age,
right.
The technologies he's talking about, there's a poll out every 3 days now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's like somebody's got their finger on the pulse, the body politic, every day taking this damn temperature.
The perception that we have received
on these highways and byways here in Central Texas. Now, this is Redneck Texas where we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and we receive more peace signs than screw your signs.
There you go.
We've received more people blowing away.
I've seen three of that.
Yeah.
The whole time.
I've only seen one.
There you go.
And to come across Central Texas, this is bush country.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I mean, this is real bush country. This is where people chew tobacco and have their rifle in the back of their window and their pickup truck. There is an awakening taking place. And my grandma used to say, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening to the Bush White House, is that the people are beginning to wake up and see that there's... You know, there was a time that you know, anytime you say anything against America, they call you a communist. And that discredited everybody. They said, well, you know, he's communist. This Dr. King was a communist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know.
Probably had been a terrorist in 2006.
Yeah. Right? He's a terrorist.
Yeah, now today, the fear word is terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of you who understand the dynamics of Christianity is based on forgiveness. That's what the New Testament is all about. That's the whole reason Christ came to earth. It's about forgiveness. And what do you do with your enemies? You forgive them. You know, if there was any great lesson that Martin Luther King taught us, this is Martin's teaching. I mean, ain't no doubt about it, this is his teaching. When we were being beaten in the streets of Birmingham, and I've got scars on my body from the police dogs, Dr. King said we must learn to forgive them.
Have you done it?
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. At first, I thought that Martin Luther King was out of his mind, and I said, well, you know, Governor Wallace needs a fist, and, you know, but another sandwich. I was at, years after Dr. King had been killed, I think about 5 years after his death, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, where it was his first pastorship, had his anniversary. And the King family invited all of us to come to this anniversary. And it was held on a Sunday night at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery. And the church was packed. I mean, standing room only. There was nothing. And it was raining real hard, storming. And Dr. King's friends, his staff, his board, the people who worked with him in this church, his family, his children, his mother and father. And in the middle of that service, the doors of that church came open, the back doors, and in came Governor Wallace being pushed in a wheelchair by a huge, big old black man. And of course, at first I was hissing and booing from us. And in order for him to push Governor Wallace up toward the pulpit, people had to pardon, had to get out of the way because the aisles were packed with people even sitting on the floor. And when they got Wallace up to, well, he couldn't get him into the pulpit because he was in a wheelchair. And there was no lift up, no way to push him up there. So he got him down in front of the pulpit. And there was still some hissing and some booing. And Daddy King had stood up, who was an old man by now, you know, a real old man, probably in his 80s, and raised his hand and asked people not to boo and hiss and don't curse him. And he said, don't curse in my son's church. And Daddy King, with his cane, came down from the pulpit and asked Governor Wallace, what do you want in my son's church? And this is a church packed with those of us who've got scars on our bodies from the struggles in Alabama, and some of us who've lost friends in Alabama movements. And Wallace took the microphone out of Daddy King's hand and tried to speak. And each time he tried to speak, tears just ran down his eyes. Mm-hmm. And I sat in that church that night, because this is 5 years after Dr. King. So, you know, I'm not even 30 years old yet. I'm about 27, 28-year-old kid. And that's when I began to realize that how right Dr. King was in terms of this forgiveness thing. that he told us that if we forgive George Wallace, George Wallace would overcome his hatred of us. And if we give back to George Wallace bitterness and hatred and violence, we will never save his soul. And here was George Wallace in Martin Luther King's church, unable to speak, so overcome with tears. And eventually Mrs. King came down, and he reached up from his wheelchair with his big long arms, and Coretta bent down. When he heard Coretta, the church just, I mean, it's just like, I mean, it was my mountaintop experience. Mm-hmm. It was, and no doubt about my mountaintop experience, to realize that that there is magic in this thing called love and forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to hug all of us and apologize to all of us. And this man who had hated us and who had inflicted so much pain and bloodshed on us became our friend. And we all went to his funeral. I still talk to his son. You know, when I wouldn't go through Alabama without calling his son. So, you know, to me that's the evidence of how right Dr. King was about this question of love and forgiveness. This agape is what he called it.
Wow.
Nice.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Technology is one thing, but really talking to people person to person as we go along the road is really the way that people have always learned and have been inspired. And that's, and I think that there's a whole lot less of that right now, and that's part of our problem, is that there is so much less face-to-face, so much less time for people to talk to one another. So it seems kind of revolutionary in a way to get from one place to another the same way humans have gotten there for most of the time there have been humans.
Sure.
It's only in the last, 100 years that we had the luxury of wheels under us. So I just find it's very inspiring and touching to talk to people. And you can look at folks and think, they're going to hate me or they're going to hate this idea. And first thing you know, they're asking questions or being friendly. And I mean, I think it's profoundly inspiring. And I also want to say that I guess it would be a kind of a maybe a preacherly thing to say, but my heart is very full to be with you all, and I won't say any more so it won't bubble out of my eyes. So thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to say one little tag about this communication with people as we go along and things that have happened just in the infancy of this march right here. One thing that really struck me was when I first heard of a lady that said she was cutting her ExxonMobil credit card in half with a pair of scissors.
I talked to her this morning.
Oh, wow. Did you talk to her this morning? And we're talking about technology and all. We have this little microphone right here, and I imagine this is going to go up on the blogs and all. So if we have this opportunity to relate with this is happening. And then there's another man said he was going to cut his in half. And it reminds me back in the days of Vietnam when we had draft car burnings and whatever.
Yeah.
So why don't we do this? Everybody that hears this out across this country and our friends and neighbors around the globe, because we know this is going to be held and heard around the world, what we're doing here. If you happen to have the misfortune of having an ExxonMobil credit card in your pocket purse, wallet, drawer, and your most secretive places where you hide these things, just find yourself a nice pair of scissors or a good straight razor and cut that credit card in half and send one card to ExxonMobil corporate headquarters in Irving, Texas, one half of the card, and kindly send the other half of the card to the Crawford Peace House, Crawford, Texas, 9142, is it West 5th Street, Howdy? West, yeah. East.
Huh? Maybe they should cut it this way so they'll still have the number and the expiration date to send to the Peace House.
Yeah, send it probably the number. But send one card, one half of the card to Exxon, the other half to Crawford Peace House, 9142 East 5th Street, Crawford, Texas. What is the zip, buddy?
76638.
76638. And we'll build a monument out of these ExxonMobil calls, cards being cut up. And I think that's part of the redeeming of the soul.
No, earlier we go.
9,145 today.
Yeah.
That goes to Walmart today.
Yep. The Exxon Mobil, number one today on
Number one.
The rich shall be poor.
Biggest man on the block.
Before we close, anybody's birthday today?
That we would be at these great big church rallies, and Dr. King would say, and what we're going to do is get Peter Johnson, young Reverend Peter Johnson, to come up and lead us, and we should... And then he just go sit down and cross his leg. But I would always get up and call somebody up who I knew could say, and look back at him and say, man, I'm going to get you.
Gordon, you think the people in this room have food for thought for keeping Martin Luther King's memory alive now?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no question about it.
I'll never forget it. after they killed Emmett Till, like they did. Admitted that they did and didn't do anything. That was it for us. Emmett Till in Mississippi.
Come on. I have something to say. And that is just that this movement probably is going to be worldwide eventually.
Right.
Or starting from here. And that I think we need to really address all the world, all the humans, that they are a part of the human race.
Right.
And that there is no real minority. We're all in the same boat. And the only difference is our ideas of how we should run the world. And if we all come together and try to help each other out, that is how we will get the true New World Order to be good.
There's this great concept. I'm sorry, it's so good. Electrical engineers know it. It's called phase transition. And what happens is, at the quantum level, as you flick a light switch on or off, all the atoms, they can't predict which ones start. The little guys start clicking over either on or off. At a certain point, critical mass is met, and they all click and point one direction. So this is another image to like think about how we all want to drag other atoms with us as we're pulling along doing this worldwide. Phase transition. Phase transition.
I think the statement that the 16-year-old young man made
here.
Let's not make any holes in the boat.
That's only one race. So that's a human race.
Right.
Sweetie,
you too.
That's right.
You guys rock. Good job.
We shall overcome.